Good evening, everyone. Always a pleasure to be here on Thursday night, this regular Thursday night rendezvous. A few nights ago, I listened to a podcast in which an old friend who's a photographer was presenting a project that he's involved in that involves a project that he's now probably over 70. I think he's probably 75 or something. But when he was 27 years old, for a month, he was the assistant of Henri Cartier-Bresson, who was a great French photographer. And it just so happened that Bresson was going to be in the United States and in New Jersey, of all places, doing a project about the state of New Jersey. And my friend was, because he knew the producer of the television program that was doing it, was assigned to be Cartier-Bresson's assistant. And so he, in his podcast the other night, he was talking about Cartier-Bresson and how the project went. And as if you know anything about Cartier-Bresson, he's famous for what he called le moment décisif, the decisive moment. In taking a photograph, there was a decisive moment, and that's when he snapped the photo. But he didn't know what that was. He didn't know what the decisive moment was. And he said, and my friend Peter quoted him, that he had told Peter, you need to, if you forget yourself, the people who you're taking a photograph of will forget you too. And that's what he wanted. He wanted it to be just natural. He didn't want people to think they were being photographed. They were in offices and schools and factories, people walking down the street, all kinds of just daily activity of the people of New Jersey. And it was very much a process rather than a process-oriented photography instead of results-organized photography. And that, doesn't that sound familiar to us? The decisive moment is just this moment. He also, Cartier-Bresson also told him, they were sitting having a coffee near a beach in New Jersey, which it's the Atlantic coast, and so it's a bit like Portugal. It has big waves, although it's not famous for surfing like Portugal is, but there's a lot of surfing there anyway. And Cartier-Bresson said to Peter, you know, photography is like surfing. I can't make the wave, but I can ride it. And the same thing with photography. I can't make any scene, I can't make anything happen, but I can ride with what is happening, and without having a, when you're surfing, I mean, I don't really know much about surfing, but what I do know is you ride the wave and you don't know where it will take you. And you know you will wash up on the beach, or you hope you will wash up on the beach, but you don't know where it will take you, that wave. And this also is interesting, thinking of photography as like surfing. And the decisive moment, I guess, is like, you know, there's the the moment of the riding the wave, you know, or the, it, there's a term for that in surfing. I can't remember what it is. It's a similar thing where you catch the wave right at the right moment, in the right place, the right time. So as I was, you know, listening to this, I was also thinking about our study group on Saturday, in which we had a discussion about faith. The poem that was being studied was Verses on the Faith Mind. So there was a question about what is faith, and the whole poem is about that, obviously, right? So, and I thought, you know, when I was listening to Peter talk about Cartier-Bresson, and Peter himself, who is a photographer and is successful, and his own work, and he said about Cartier-Bresson that it was at a time, it was in 1975 that they did this project. And he said it was a time, I wrote it down, when that is different than now, because now the pure not knowing pleasure of photography is gone. The pure not knowing pleasure. And I think what he meant, Peter, I didn't get a chance to ask, but I think what he meant is that today with photography, with, you know, digital photography, you take the picture and then you immediately look and, oh, that's not good, and you throw it away. Or you say, oh, that one's good, I'll keep that one. I think it was something like that he meant. And we're just inundated with images, instantaneous images, where when we're working with the old-fashioned cameras, it wasn't like that. You took the pictures. I remember taking pictures, and you didn't know what you were getting. And then you took the film and had it developed, or in the case of professional photographers, they develop it themselves, and print and whatever, and then you see, and it emerges. Whereas with us, with all of our phone cameras and digital cameras, it's not at all like that. But when Peter said that, my friend, he said it kind of with, first he said that the pure not knowing pleasure is gone today. But then he thought for a minute and he said, well, maybe not. Which I interpret to mean that the process, rather than the result, is still very true for him. So he still doesn't know what he's shooting. He's still present to the decisive moment, I think. And this takes faith. That's where it comes back to what we were talking about on Saturday in our study group, faith. Which faith is, you know, has a lot of meanings for us. We think of, you know, like religious faith, but that's not what this is what we're talking about in Zen. It's not faith in something outside of you. It's not even faith in something. It's faith in no thing. When we talked about it on Saturday, I think I mentioned something about how faith mind, which is in the title of that poem, is the equivalent of just this. So this moment, right now, this, it, as we sometimes say, that's faith mind. Being one with whatever we're doing, living non-dualistically, that's faith. Just, you know, Peter just carrying his camera and clicking at this decisive moment, absolute faith. It's about a confidence and a trust in our experience, our direct experience, and when we put ourselves wholeheartedly into whatever we do, then we directly experience whatever it is, you know, if, whether it's surfing a wave or surfing the wave of the moment with a camera, whether it's sitting down on your cushion, trying to finish a project in your workplace, making your dinner, whatever it is, we put ourselves wholeheartedly into it. There's no separation, in other words. That's to have faith in no thing. We have faith in just whatever is. So if it's sadness we're feeling, we have faith in that. If we are feeling happiness, we have faith in that. We trust it. It's just what is. Without judgments, because usually when we say living non-dualistically, that means not judging it. So not thinking we have to come and sit here tonight with a certain attitude, with a certain point. Of course, the truth is, generally we come on the Thursday night because we know there will be a talk. So already there is a result we're expecting. We don't know what that talk will be, however. So there's faith involved in this, because you don't know what I will say. You don't know if I will talk. Juan always asks, are you going to talk? Sometimes it's not me who talks. Sometimes it's Joa. Sometimes, although we haven't for a long time had guests, but sometimes we have guests who speak. Sometimes we do a circle. But you come here with the faith, of not knowing, actually, because you don't know what will happen. You don't know who will speak or if there will be speech. Apparently, a few weeks ago, maybe it was when we were on retreat, Joa did a guided meditation. Or maybe it was some other night when I was not here. Anyway, Joa Sensei led a guided meditation. Something completely, no one expected it. But everyone had come with the faith of not knowing. Maybe some people were disappointed. Maybe some people were very happy. Maybe some people left. Maybe some people were confused, thinking, what is he doing? Why not? Whatever you were feeling, that's your way. That's your wholehearted way, as we say. And so if we, you know, I think if I come back to Cartier-Bresson, if we approach the moment the way that he does when he's a photographer, apparently he's not always like that, Peter said. He was not what was it? There was a moment when someone from the television program wanted to interview him. And he became really désagréable, we say in French, like really unpleasant, and didn't really want to talk and didn't really want to cooperate. Whereas when he was in his element as a photographer with Peter and with the people he was photographing, there was none of that. So it's not all or one all the time, right? So why did I have that little diversion about him not being always like that? Well, I know what it was, yeah. When he's taking a photo, if he has no expectations and it's not result oriented, then there's no fear. There's no fear of whether it will be a good picture or a bad picture. And actually, Peter said when they got the contact sheets back, he looked at them very quickly marked the ones with, you know, the red grease pencil, marked the ones that he wanted, to, that they were selecting for the television program, and then gave the contacts to Peter and left everything, went back to France and left everything. The negatives, the contacts, left everything to Peter and said he was done with them. He didn't want it anymore. So that's why today, how many years later? 40 years later, or no, more than that, almost 50 years, right? 75? Am I wrong about that? Yeah, almost 50 years. Peter has all of his work and approached the Cartier-Bresson Foundation in Paris and the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And the New Yorker heard about it. And so there's this spread in the New Yorker with an interview with Peter and all this. But Cartier, the point is, Cartier-Bresson just, he was done. He had one stipulation, and this was always throughout his entire career. He never cropped a photo. He never cropped his photos. I don't know if you know what cropping photos means. Does everybody? You know, he never, like, you know, cut out part of it to focus on one element of it. Never. And that was like complete, violated all of his process and his work of the decisive moment and everything. Well, the US television producer people cropped the photos for the television program. Although the producer who had worked with Peter insisted, no, you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that. She was young, she was 25, a woman. Peter thinks it was because she was a young woman. They didn't listen to her and they cropped the photos. And Cartier-Bresson, his agent, all of his people were furious, disowned the whole thing, didn't allow the work to be used in the documentary. It was a scandal. So although he's not result-oriented, he does respect his process and what the essence is for him. I'm talking, Cartier-Bresson is dead, but this is what I understand. And what does that mean for us then? No? Does that mean we never change anything in our lives? Does that mean we never, if we make a soup and it needs to have something added, we don't add it? Or if it needs more water, we don't add more water? No, that's not what it means. It means that we give ourselves entirely to whatever it is we do and ride that wave to its completion. It takes great faith because we don't know where that wave will take us. But we trust, if we can have confidence in our way, if we're not attached to some result or goal, in the sense of it has to be like this. I have to have this soup and it has to be like that. You know, you can have a recipe for a soup and every time you make it, it tastes different. At least in my case, it does, you know. Or like with Orioki, as I've said recently when we were doing Orioki, we all have more or less the same size cloth. And when we sit down and make the little rectangle on which we will put our bowls, theoretically, we should all have the same rectangle because we all have the same cloth. But we don't all have the same cloth. The different textures, different colors, different sizes, a little bit different. And even though I've had the same cloth for almost 25 years, every time I make that rectangle, it's different. Every single time. yet I have faith, trust that it will be okay. Whatever that rectangle looks like, it'll be okay. Sometimes it looks really shitty. Sometimes it's like, you know, kind of crooked. The top is bigger than the bottom. I have very difficult cloth, I must admit, because it's really kind of hard to manage, but it doesn't matter. It's okay, you know? I have faith that it will be all right. In fact, you know, we go to sleep every night and we have faith in, I don't know, that we will fall asleep. Although sometimes when we're like in phases of insomnia, we can't. It's like terrible. Because we're like trying to fall asleep. As soon as we start thinking about it, as soon as we start attaching to something, it's like the image from Tintin that I've talked about before. The Captain Haddock. I don't know if, you know, in Portugal you have Tintin, or yeah, you do. Okay. And so there's Captain Haddock. I don't know what his name is in Portuguese, but he's got this big beard, you know. And someone asks him if he sleeps with his beard under the blanket or on top of the blanket. Why? I can't remember why they ask him that. He like becomes insomniac for weeks or days or something because he doesn't know. Suddenly he doesn't know. Should I have it under the blanket or on top of the blanket? And it's like, you know, these scenes of him like panicking, he can't sleep. Wow. I mean, I can identify, not that, but with this similar kind of thing. As soon as I start thinking about it, wanting it to be something, I mean, this is part of my calvaire, my, you know, my deep anguish as a writer is as soon as I get into that mode of wanting a result, forget it, I can't even write, you know, I'm lost. And then it feeds on itself. It becomes bigger and bigger the more I have the expectations. Cartier-Bresson avoided all of that, or had learned, I guess, to trust this process of not knowing, and just seeing what happens. And the same thing can apply to our lives at every moment. That's basically what I'm saying here. Because none of us are Cartier-Bresson. As far as I know, none of us are Capitaine Haddock. But we can relate. We probably have moments like Cartier-Bresson when we can just trust. And we probably have moments like Captain Haddock when we are totally freaked out. And our practice is, our sitting practice is a terrific tool to help us plunge into this wholehearted way and living non-dualistically. When we sit down and let things settle, forget what we know, you know, try to let go of all the stuff that we want to happen or we think should happen or what we think it is. I recently saw this quote from Claude Monet, you know, great painter, who and reminded me totally of this meditation that I even talked about at the retreat recently. He said, "To see, we must forget the name of what we are looking at, of the thing we are looking at." So if we're stuck on the name of it, then we're not really seeing it. And that's why that translation meditation that I don't know if anyone, Lisa was definitely there. I don't know if Luciana was there the day I talked about it, but Debbie was there too. This translation meditation where you decide you will translate whatever you see, whatever arises, in a different language. But you have to pick a language that you don't speak first before you start the meditation period. You know, so if you don't speak Turkish, you choose that. If you don't speak Russian, you choose that. Whatever, Swahili, I don't know. And then whatever arises, so like Monet, he says, to see, we must forget the name of the thing we are looking at. But that's really hard to do. But this translating helps, because if I try to translate what this is in Russian, I don't speak Russian. So I have to, in order to translate, I have to forget the name that I know in several languages, forget those, and then try to find the word in Russian. But I don't speak Russian, so I can't find a word for it. So I have a better chance of really seeing it, because I don't have a name for it. The ultimate test is with ourselves. So trying to identify who we are without all of the names we have for ourselves, whether it's given names, Dharma names. Already getting a Dharma name is like a step away from your given name. We talked about that recently here, I think, or somewhere. But even away from the Dharma name, and then away from the names of the labels, you know, woman, man, young, old, brother, sister, father, mother, daughter, friend, cousin, writer, photographer, teacher, driver, dentist, whatever it is, you know, golfer, whatever it is. When we don't have any of those things, who are we? Who am I then, when I get rid of all of that? And that's where the greatest reward is of spiritual practices, is because that's what we're looking for. That's, we're looking into the nature of being and the nature of self, the nature of who we are. And it's not religion. I think I talked about that last week. It's not religion. Religions can be spiritual in nature, but spirituality is always looking into the nature of things and being. And it doesn't matter what kind of religious forms we put around it. The essence, the real basis of spirituality is that. And I think we talked about this last week. I can't remember, but I think we did. Any case, yeah, Cartier-Bresson. And so my friend Peter said that he was a young photographer at the time, and he hadn't quite found really what his way was it. He was totally enthralled to Cartier-Bresson, who's this great magnum photographer. But he hadn't quite found his way yet. And he later came to, so Cartier-Bresson was the decisive moment and this pure not knowing, forget yourself, and people forget you. And Peter's work became the same kind of thing of coming upon, let's see, how would you say this? Like the connections between images. So, you know, he might take photos of different things. And then when he looked at the context sheet, he would see the connection. And so he does these like triptych present things with, he has like three images that are juxtaposed. And then in the performance, he will like take one away and put another, a new one in, and they kind of all flow in one into the other. So there's like this real continuous decisive moment going on. And this letting go of this image is about that, and this image is about that, and they have nothing to do with each other. It's like seeing what they share, what is common, instead of what separates them, which is a really interesting process too. Now, Peter is a Zen practitioner. He says he thinks that he doesn't know if Cartier-Bresson was a Buddhist practitioner, but I think he was actually. I think I've heard that he was. I don't know why I think that, but, or at least he was familiar with the Buddhist teachings in any case. So you see, I know I'm giving my friend's example of of how when you put yourself wholeheartedly into what you do with faith, with great faith, something arises. Something happens. What that is, what that thing is mysterious, of course. But you know it when you see it. You feel it when you experience it. And it's something that is, cannot be, you can't, you can, someone said, you know, you can read about love and people can tell you about love, but unless you've experienced it, you don't really know what love is. And when, you know, there's been all this talk about, you know, artificial intelligence and these applications, the ChatGPT, and that can write, can respond to questions and even tell jokes and write long, elaborate things. And someone said, you know, that ultimately what they cannot do, what artificial intelligence cannot do, is touch the poetic, I wrote this down, the poetic truth of things. The feeling of their strangeness, that the artificial intelligence can't touch upon that. Because this is something that has to do with our heart and with our the essence of our being. The computer, the artificial intelligence, can't experience that directly. And I would bet, I mean, I don't know enough about it, but that, you know, some sort of artificial intelligence photographer would not be able to capture the decisive moment that Cartier-Bresson caught. Apparently, he also told Peter something like, he's not interested in what is happening, he's interested in what is going to happen. Not in the sense of like projecting, but if he's fixed on this moment, he'll miss then what will arise. So he has to let go of this moment and trust what arises. And then when he, you know, Peter showed one of the contact sheets, and there were maybe seven, there was a whole, you know, probably, I don't know, 20, probably 30 picture, little, you know, contacts on the sheet. And there were only like five or six that were marked. So a lot of them he doesn't keep. It's as if he's so in tune to the decisive moment that he knows it when he sees it on the contact sheet. Although he didn't necessarily see it when he was snapping the photos. Trust, faith, great faith. And when you sit down on your cushion, you're demonstrating great faith. You have no idea what will happen. You may have some ideas about what you would like to happen. Oh, I would really like to relax. It's been a hectic day. Or, oof, I'm really tired. I might just fall asleep here. Or, I hope my legs won't hurt this time. Or, ooh, this is really nice. That's a really experience, a clear experience of something. Or, I don't know, whatever it is. But yet, ultimately, there's some great faith involved in sitting down there because you don't really know what will happen. And yet you trust. You trust in just this. And that's faith mind. So we have some time if people would like to comment, share. Too bad I don't have any pictures of Cartier-Bresson to like share. But... Questions, comments? Joao.
Good evening, everyone. When you were talking earlier about the labels in thinking of our experience of the world and our experience of ourselves also through names and labels, I remembered a couple of weeks ago I went outside for a walk in the park with my kids actually. This we can do this anywhere, sitting here, without realizing. Well, I was without realizing at first. I was really experiencing the whole moment, the whole experience, without that medium of the names, the tree or the leaf or the pebble or my kids and by my side, and then what I also realized, it may seem very obvious, but I had never realized it, that something else we also put labels on, it's the different kind of experience we have. We name something, we call something smelling, and we call something else seeing, and we call something else touching. So there's also labels for that. We tend to separate maybe sometimes all of these things. So that was I was kind of surprised actually when I realized it. There's also names for the, I don't know, the different kinds of ways that we can experience the world. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, and when we do that, then we categorize and limit, you know, instead of just the being, just this. Even being is a label. However, it's kind of a label that is hard to grasp what that means, but we know what it means. Experientially, we know what that means. But yeah, it's interesting, huh? How we look around and we put labels on everything. And ultimately, behind all those labels, there's actually nothing. Because we really look deeply into it, it's all, and that's what we mean by empty, you know? Which actually is just another way of saying it's full. It doesn't mean what we usually think about. That label of empty doesn't mean what we think it means. Is anyone familiar with Cartier-Poisson's work? I mean, you know, like, I mean, everybody's heard of him. I mean, a lot of people have probably heard of him, right? But and that decisive moment is really his trademark thing that he always said about his work. Yeah, Lisa?
Yeah. Sorry, my voice is a bit off tonight. I'm just wondering, though, if it's not the trademark of a lot of photographers, because that's what you have to, or a lot of creation process is just to be open to what arises. And I imagine a lot of people I know some photographers used to set up the scenes, obviously, but the little story about Cartier-Bresson is that my mother used to work in a gallery and he actually Cartier-Bresson was also he would have liked to be a painter actually before being a photographer, and he spent the later part of his life actually doing drawing, and so they exhibited a lot of his drawings at the end of his life, just mainly paysage, like sceneries and stuff. Cartier-Bresson.
Yeah, thank you. I knew that about him, that he drew. I forgot about that. Yeah. Well, and the thing about, right, there are like rules of composition for photos. You know, like there's a good photo is supposed to be one third this, one third this, one third this. There's all these, when you learn photography, they teach you all this stuff. I took one photography course once, so I know these basic stuff, but. And a lot of photographers stick to that. And if you don't do that, then they consider that the photograph is not good. So I'm sure there are some who do. I think Cartier-Bresson pushed it to an extreme, though, and not no cropping. Most photographers crop their photos so that it looks, you know, so that the composition will be right or the image will focus on what they want it to focus on, things like that. Because Luciana's here, Shogyam Trungpa had a whole Dharma art around photography. And I recently, on Herb Elsky's podcast series, heard this woman, I can't remember her name, Helen something, she's Dutch. And she does this, she works with this Trungpa's photography. And, you know, much of what she said was what Cartier-Bresson said, you know, it's process oriented. That the results and the ideas we have and the composition and everything that gets in the way. Yes, thank you. That's her name, Helen Vink. Yeah. Gets in the way of perception. So it would get in the way of seeing things as they are. And that's true for a photographer, but that's true for all of us. Our ideas about whatever we're seeing. Or even the idea, like, you know, Joan says, the idea that we are seeing or we are smelling or something, the idea gets in the way of the direct experience of it. And I'm not sure that all photographers would well, I'm sure there's a lot who don't. And this woman, Helen Vink, she told her story. She had been, an art photographer before meeting the Shambhala path and everything. And she, when she first went to one of these Dharma art photography things, knowing nothing about Buddhism or anything, she was horrified. And she thought, this is like against everything I've ever learned, And she thought the pictures were bad that people were taking. They didn't look good, according to the established way that photographs are supposed to look and be taken and whatever. Now, I wonder if Cartier-Bresson, with his drawing, if he pursued it in an academic way, if he learned about drawing and then... I would doubt that he did. He probably learned the basic technique, but then threw it all away, like we were saying, throwing, or was that here we say that, or in the retreat, I forgot. But you have to master the technique, of course, but in Shogyam Trungpa's path of photography, there's not even that. There's no mastering of technique even. I think Cartier-Bresson probably had some mastery of that. I'm sure he did, some mastery of the techniques. But then he could throw it away. Like Picasso. Picasso was an amazing draftsman, beautiful drawings. He really mastered the art of drawing. And then look what he did. He just deconstructed all of it. But you can see in his work, you can see that there is that essence of seeing. And then he's trying to reproduce what he's seeing. And by when you're drawing, you see the spaces around what you're drawing. You see the spaces more than the lines, actually. And Helen Vink said, which is really a beautiful thing. She said, "Eyes have no opinions." Maybe she was quoting Trungpa, I don't know, but eyes have no opinions. And so perception doesn't, when you're seeing something, it's no opinion. After then we put opinions on it. We like it or we don't, it's nice or it's not, it's beautiful or it's not, whatever. But in that, in the faith in not knowing, there are no opinions. We've let go of the opinions. But if we're stuck on opinions about things, if we're seeing with our opinions, then we have difficulty then being fully. Not separate from whatever it is.
Can I just say something about decisive moment? Mm-hmm. I think it is Roland Barthes. He wrote a lot about photography. And I once have a teacher that he said very often something like, I don't know how to translate, but I ask João to help me. About this decisive moment, Roland Barthes said, isto foi. João, podes me ajudar? Isto foi.
This was?
Something like that. So Roland Barthes, when he wants to speak about this decisive moment, which I agree, like Lisa said, it's common to a few, well, maybe all, I don't know, photographs. And then there is Roland Barthes, writing about theory of photography and saying, how do you say, João? this was. So the moment of the snap is gone. This was. And I remember this teacher always, when you wanted to refer to what I think it was the decisive moment for a photograph, Roland Barthes said, this was. And I think it's the same thing, I don't know.
Yeah, I do too, I think so. A different way of saying it, but I think, yeah. With words, what the photograph shows us that, you know, something like that, I think.
And it makes also the big difference from drawing or from painting. In photograph, it's like that. It's gone.
Yeah, it has that the instantaneous quality. I wonder, though, it'd be interesting to know what Cartier-Bresson, how he translated that then to his drawing. Because it does have a different quality. It's true. That, like Peter, what Peter's saying of the pure, what did I keep forgetting? He said pure not knowing pleasure, right? It's not the same with drawing. That's true, huh? But maybe there is some, I would think, because I know as a poet, I have that with writing. Of course, it doesn't manifest like a photograph, but this the sense of that pure not knowing pleasure is there. So I would imagine that he found that the equivalent in drawing. I don't know. And we're just talking about artists, but the same thing applies to all of us in our lives. You know, we can experience that in our lives when we are wholeheartedly engaged with this, just this, wholeheartedly this decisive moment. That's the hallmark of Zen. Yes, Antoine, you have your hand up?
Yeah, maybe about drawing. As you were mentioning Picasso before, there is an amazing movie from Henri-Georges Clouzot, who's a French director, and he's basically shooting Picasso is painting on the camera. So you can see the drawing starting, it starts to become something, and then it becomes something else, and you can really experience that is not knowing. This painting, you see a form appears and then another one, and then it becomes again another one. And the whole movie is just Picasso, pretty old. You don't see him at all. You just see it's like the white screen, and you see the painting appearing and changing and transforming.
What do you remember the name of that film?
Yeah, it's called Le Mystère Picasso.
Le Mystère, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was thinking it was the L'Instant Picasso, which would fit, but the Mystère Picasso too works, huh? Yeah, absolutely.
And there's also a picture, I don't know if it was done at the same time, there's a picture of him, a photograph of him, taken, I don't know, for 1 second or something, I'm not sure, where with a small flashlight, he draws in the air, exactly like you were describing, but it's a picture, it did it really quickly, and you can see the drawing. So because we were talking about drawing and photograph, it's an interesting... Maybe he was trying to put it all together in some way.
Yeah. Yeah, and all of this is what our Zen practice is about. Coming back to just this. We just do what needs to be done, what is here now. We respond to whatever arises with the freedom of Picasso or Cartier-Bresson or Roland Barthes or whoever. It's really, that's what this is about. And then there's great freedom. if we have great faith, and we live, we are wholeheartedly engaged with whatever we are doing, then we're free, actually. Time is almost up. So unless anyone has one last thing to say, I think we'll stop there. Okay. Thank you.